Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the expansion of the vote to women throughout the 20th century has had an impact on the discourses and politics of war and peace. What exactly was that impact? Doug Becker explores in a conversation about the new book, The Suffragist Peace.
I'm Doug Becker. The 20th century was one of the most violent centuries in world history. Two world wars, the advent of nuclear warfare, and an unprecedented number of mass atrocities and genocides marked the period. But it also saw the expansion of democracy in equally unprecedented manners as well. Perhaps the most notable on the expansion of democracy is the expansion of the vote to women. On today's show, we will explore the role of the suffragist movement and the expansion of the vote to women on issues of peace and war. We'll ask whether or not women as voters have had a profound impact on the ways in which we frame issues of the politics of war and women leaders, and whether they are more likely to be peaceful or more warlike, or perhaps equally warlike. Our guests today have written a new book on these topics. It's entitled The Suffragist Peace: How Women Shaped the Politics of War. Our guests are Robert Traeger. He is a full professor in the political science department at the University of California, Los Angeles. On top of this book, he's the author of a forthcoming Diplomacy, Communication, and the Origins of International Order. And Jocelyn Barnhart is assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She is also the senior research scientist at DeepMind in London. And again, on top of this book, she's the author of The Consequences of Humiliation, Anger, and Status Threat in International Politics. Thank you both very much for joining us. Robert Traeger, I'll ask you the first question. The book addresses a sort of a broad question about the role of women as voters and the impact on conflict. In the intro, suggesting that the 20th century has been particularly violent, but has expanded the vote. Are these two related?
Well, that was the mystery that we started with. Mm-hmm. We wanted to know because I think there's so much opinion on this question. I think many people think, of course, women leaders, of course, women voters have made the world more peaceful. And I think many people are absolutely on the opposite side of that question. They simply think that that is not the case, that this is a myth. In fact, opinions on this question don't really divide along political lines. There are, for instance, people who would consider themselves on the left who absolutely think it is just wrong to think of women having had this impact on the system through voting. And there are people on the right that think that it is wrong, and indeed for very different reasons and coming at it from a different point of view. So we wanted to get to the truth, and that's what this book is really about.
And I guess then, so we don't bury the lead here, ultimately, what are some of the sort of big, broad findings? Jocelyn, I'll ask you.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, our original intuition was that we have this very, very robust survey data, which shows that there are women on average have more pacific views on a range of conflict issues when compared to men. And this is so robust that it has, you know, been noted around the world and across, you know, time. And so our original intuition was, you know, how does this account for something like the democratic peace theory, which has been said to be one of the only laws within international relations? Wouldn't we intuitively think that it's not only about institutions and the institution of voting, but also the preferences that are being represented within those votes? And so we looked at this statistically. We looked from starting, in 1816, when a lot of our data on war and peace begins, and looked up through the current era. And definitely found that, in fact, dyads, or two countries that are both democratic and have women voters, were less likely to fight than two democracies that did not have women voters and than two autocracies. And so this was, you know, robust across a really large number of statistical and analytical approaches. So that was really what we set out to find. And I don't, you know, I think ultimately we found that we didn't, not a lot of support for a democratic peace in the traditional sense of, you know, the institutions of voting are what bring peace, but really that it is more about who votes matters in conjunction with obviously having healthy democratic systems.
And Robert, I know within your data, one of the suggestions here, it's always been one of the challenges of democratic peace is we have a tendency to view that as democracy is dichotomous, either you are democratic or not, as opposed to the reality that democracy is much more on a sliding scale. So therefore, the right for women to vote, the, you know, granting women the vote is a necessary but potentially insufficient condition in the sense that it's not just that women have the ability to vote, but they actually do, right? So voter turnout among women really does figure pretty significantly.
Yeah, exactly. So what we found was it's not just the electorate and it's not just the institutions of democracy. It's the combination of those things. You actually need a whole range of democratic institutions to be sure that the preferences are not sure, but to have a chance, I think would be more accurate, to have a chance that the preferences that are embodied in the electorate really translate into policy, particularly in key moments when questions of war and peace are on the table. So you need those institutions of democracy, and there are many of them. You need protections of the rule of law. You need freedom of the press. You need constraints on the executive. You need lots of things that help democracy to function. But then you also need to have an electorate that has a set of preferences. And that's something that we were adding because I think previous work on the democratic peace had largely really focused on the institutional aspects of things. But in fact, that just simply isn't enough. There isn't much evidence for an institutional democratic peace. That is, there isn't much evidence that the institutions of democracy align the preferences of rulers and ruled in such a way that the result is that democracies don't fight each other. What there is more evidence for, we were finding, is when the electorates, and in particular, when there are women in the electorates, then those electorates, when they are faithfully represented by democratic institutions, they tend not to fight each other.
Jocelyn, we're making an assumption here that I'd really like to interrogate a bit. Are women more peaceful? Are their policy preferences more peaceful?
Well, the surveys, like just countless surveys have shown that they are. Obviously, this is an average, right? Obviously, there are distributions of preferences about war and peace just as there are about anything. And obviously, you know, we're not making any categorical statements about, you know, women or men, but to say that, you know, there are patterns that we find. Again, there have been these surveys that have been done, you know, in every continent almost around the world and across large timescales, essentially since the beginning of survey polling in the 1930s, that have found differences. Now, the size of these differences can vary. They tend to be largest in Japan and places, you know, at one end of the scale. And I think some of the smallest differences have been noticed in Israel. So, you know, I think that range can be anywhere between, you know, 15% less likely to support the use of force when compared to, you know, 4 or 5% less likely. So there is a range, obviously. You know, there's nothing nothing uniform, right? But these averages exist. And so that is it is just a very robust public polling finding.
I just add there that just because I, you know, I want everybody to understand that it is absolutely not the case that women are pacifists and men are warmongers or anything like that. You know, obviously there is always a robust minority who believes in either war or peace in any conflictual situation. And so, and we also see that many of the same factors, almost always the same factors that influence people who self-report as being male and people who self-report as being female, almost always exactly the same factors are affecting the one as are affecting the other. That is, there's a trend over time in support for the use of force when force is being contemplated. And you see male support being higher than female support, but the two very, very much together. And you see that in place after place after place, which is really quite extraordinary. So even when, you know, there's 60% in support in the male population, there's 50% or 45% in support in the female population. Similarly, when only minorities of both self-reporting male and female respondents are supporting the use of force. So it's not at all that they are pacifists or warmongers, but it is the case that there seems to be a baseline difference. Now, whether that baseline difference is due down to nature or nurture is, of course, a really fraught and absolutely fascinating question that we get into a bit, but it is ultimately hard to have a definitive answer.
Yeah, you raised the issue. I will ask the question, Jocelyn, that nature, nurture, you know, within the book, you do wrestle, you know, with that question. And I think broadly, I mean, it's such an important question in the area of, you know, feminist theory within international relations. You know, how much is it nature? How much is it nurture? How much is it political culture that's leading to these averages? And you seem to be suggesting the numbers, it's not dramatic, like women are 80% less likely to support a war or something. It, you know, the numbers, you know, tend to be what, more like 10-15% or so, you know, in those range. But is there something about the way women view war that may be somewhat natural, or at least enshrined in gender constructions? Or is it political choices made by women? By women leaders?
Yeah, I mean, we honestly, you know, we don't know. And I'm really going to pass to Robert on this one, because I think he did a lot of the really excellent research in this chapter. But I, you know, I do know that this kind of perception that women were innately, you know, more peaceful, right? This was kind of how a lot of the early suffragists thought about it, in their view that a lot of them saw this to be that, you know, women had this innate kind of, it was in part because they'd been socialized as caregivers to value human life in a different way, but also because they could give birth, and like that there was just innate maternal capacity. It was not just socialization. So that was certainly a perception at the time. It seemed, you know, the one that led them to think that giving women the vote was actually going to be the best measure to achieve universal peace. So certainly it's been perceived that way, as we've talked about and kind of alluded to. It's less common to talk about such differences and such kind of innate preferences now. But I think I'll let Robert speak more to that.
Robert, go ahead.
I mean, it's such a fraught area. You know, there's evidence on sort of both sides. It's, you know, one thing that we can reject is biological determinism. We certainly know that, you know, we can just toss that one out. You know, people, cultures have huge impact on people, very obviously. And we talk in the book a little bit about women in the Third Reich and the sorts of violent preferences that they were expressing. But obviously, you know, newsflash, men in the Third Reich also were expressing some violent preferences. So cultures have these effects, and often they have similar effects on all of the genders. But yeah, so there's sort of evidence on the one side, evidence on the other side. So, you know, you might think about evidence on the side of biology, are the consistency of the differences in preferences across the world. You know, over, I think, about 35 years, the World Value Survey has been surveying huge numbers, hundreds of thousands of people, and in every part of the world, at every point in time, more men than women are willing to see violence used politically. And differences in aggression between boys and girls show up probably prior to gender images themselves. So before they have a real understanding of what gender is, the boys, the very young boys are before 2 years of age, are more aggressive than the girls. These differences in murder rates, you know, they persist over time, and the fraction of murders per population, that changes dramatically. But the sort of proportion of men versus women who are committing these murders, that's remarkably constant in spite of all that change. And then when we look at the political surveys, of course, again, we find the same thing. So so there's some evidence on different sides, but I think, you know, many of us who think that there's a role for biology, we look to the animal kingdom, right? We look around and there it's much less controversial. And we see all of these differences in size that correspond to differences in aggression between male and female animals. And there are theories about why this is the case from an evolutionary point of view, which, you know, we can get into if you'd like, and they're fascinating and somewhat contentious, but there clearly are some patterns and they're widely accepted. And even in the animal kingdom, some people think that it could be related sometimes to culture, but culture is, you know, less leaned on in the animal kingdom. So then there's a question, well, if we believe these things are happening and these differences exist in the animal kingdom, do we actually think that we're so different? Is this another instance of human exceptionalism, which maybe is not justified? Now, add to that, that the biologists will tell us that the underlying mechanisms for aggression are highly conserved across the animal kingdom. That is, you know, people will say, oh, mice are different than humans. Well, indeed they are. But the underlying mechanisms that lead to aggression genetically are very, very similar. In some ways, mice have about one of those, if you look literally at the DNA, mice have one strand, humans have three strands, but the strands are the same sequence. So it's very, very similar. Now, the triggers for aggression are very, very different. Now, of course, this is at the personal level, and there's a question of whether that translates to the political level, but we find some evidence that it seems to, which is, there's just so much more to say, so many fascinating studies that we could go into. You know, I think I'm just trying to give you a sense of how you would weigh the evidence for and against. There is no definitive evidence, absolutely no definitive evidence on one side or the other, but I think it's fair to say that we come down on the side of there being reason to think that there are some proclivities that in the phrase of one author are organized in advance of experience. But that's not to say that the experiences that people have don't shape them and influence and change all of that. So yes, probably in our view, small hormonal differences have these large scale effects, which sort of blew our minds that we came down on that side, but that's sort of what we think. But, you know, again, there's no certainty here. You just have to weigh a lot of evidence on both sides.
And you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing today a new book, The Suffragist Peace, How Women Shaped the Politics of War, with the authors Robert Traeger of the University of California, Los Angeles, and Jocelyn Barnhart of the University of California, Santa Barbara. And to kind of, I have to admit, within the book, I found it fascinating and a little surprising as much as you delved into some of the, you know, some of the nature arguments, because I know that generally speaking in the social sciences, there's been this tendency to want to reject that approach and to focus much more on a cultural approach. But I think it was an important inclusion in the discussion. But with that, Jocelyn, moving a bit to some of the nurture arguments, and specifically on nurture, I wonder how much women's attitudes about war and peace are driven by perceptions of vulnerability. I think of going back to the suffragist movement, the fact that women getting the right to vote takes place at the same time as prohibition and alcohol, and a number of interesting work pointing out that the reason why women were driving that had quite a bit to do with, I mean, there's a lot of different factors like, you know, nationality and, you know, anti-immigration sentiment. But the women's interest was the fact that alcohol leads to alcoholism, which leads to domestic violence, and women were much more likely to be victims of domestic violence. And so with that, as you know, within the spirit, is that also the way in which suffragists would frame the importance of war, that women are unique victims of war?
Absolutely. That was certainly a part of it. So that was part of the campaign for suffrage in states like Pennsylvania, that they were actually campaign flyers that were saying that, you know, it's not only women it's not only men who die in war, right? That women pay a significant amount of the costs in war. They're not only victims of violence, they lose husbands and they lose sons and they pay the cost very directly. So I do think that there was a notion of vulnerability that is in part behind it, in addition to a notion of, you know, at least in their minds, that there was just a different valuation of human life because they give it, right? But I think that vulnerability does seem to be at the heart of it. That sounds right.
I want to follow up because you kind of slipped something in there that I definitely want to go into much more detail. That certainly the victim, the being victims of violence, perhaps uniquely vulnerable victims of violence is part of this, but the mother motif within the cultural discussions about war. And I think of it, you know, even in contemporary circles, that mothers who lose children in war kind of, they occupy a unique and important political space, particularly in protest against war, you know, opposition to war. So that's both nature and nurture, but the way that gets framed, like your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. We see that in many contemporary cases, right? Recently in Russia, there have been protests by mothers. Putin brought in a group of mothers that had to be culled because we needed to make sure that they were going to actually express support for the state, as opposed to the more vocal group that was vehemently against sending their sons off unprepared to the battle front. We've seen in the book, we talk about the case of the four mothers in Israel, which was a group that actively protested in the year 2000 to remove Israeli troops from Lebanon. And that was very much couched in, these were mothers whose sons were on the battlefront and they wanted to bring this effort home and these troops home. And so it is, I think it can be a very powerful motif. I think that mothers can speak with authority. And I think that, yes, it has been there since, you know, early notions of these discussions among the suffragists that, they were not going to send their boys off, to be lost for no reason. And so it was a protection. I mean, it is also interesting, you know, something, again, we don't find that women are not pacifists, right? And in my mind, I suspect if we had sufficient data, right, we still have surveys that we want to run about these things. But I think there's a notion that if, you know, the homeland is attacked, you're going to find equal support, right, for any sort of conflict, and use of violence is my guess, right? So there's still a notion that, like, you protect the homestead and you could do it with violence if need be. But you want to mitigate, you want to minimize unnecessary conflict. Yeah.
You mentioned two cases. One more I want to make sure to ask you this, because I find this a particularly fascinating one, is the one in Liberia. The role that women play, that in essence, broadly asking, is the reason why we've got this long war is because we're just dominated by men and dominated by masculinist approaches to power, which then led the Liberians to elect the first woman elected as, you know, as head of state. And so, I mean, and in that case, these are sort of, you know, similar approaches, I would imagine, but women asking the broad question is the reason why there's so much war is because there's just so much aggression, so much masculinity out there.
We also have cultural notions of what masculinity looks like, right? It's not just that we think of one as socialized. And so, obviously this is a topic of active debate at the moment. How do we think about socializing, you know, what masculinity means? There is a quote that I like, actually from one of the four mothers, the spokesperson, that she said, when God said to Abraham, please take your son, your only one whom you love, Isaac, Abraham did not argue. We believe that if God had approached Sarah, she would have replied, forget it, I'm not sacrificing this child. So I really like that quote, but it's not exactly to your question about, you know, kind of masculine socialization. But Robert was, you know, you thought about the case of Liberia and some of these things. Do you have things to add?
Well, you're exactly right, Douglas, that it really is a case where the the conflict and the peace movement in particular are very much gendered and conceived of in that way. These women gather together as women, recruit other women, use very culturally gender-specific modes to engage with the men who are prosecuting the war. And then they go to the peace talks. They actually go there and they camp out, these women, outside the peace talks, and they have a decisive effect, actually. I mean, it's sort of unbelievable. But when the men, all the men are sitting around the table, decide that they just can't agree, you know, too bad. Lena Gbowee, who is sort of the leader at that point among the women, she begins to do something that has a specific cultural meaning in that context. She begins to strip. And that is so shocking. And, you know, again, to your point about mothers, it's so shocking, the idea that your mother would take off all of her clothes in front of you. That is such an extreme statement, almost like an immolation. And everybody says, stop. And because they want her to stop so badly, they actually continue the peace talks. I mean, so they go back in there and they keep talking, and eventually there's an agreement. And then the women don't stop there. You know, even after they stop this war, they know that in order to really stop it permanently, they need democracy. And so they organize for democracy and they get a leader elected, happens to be a woman. And everybody sort of recognizes that this transformation is brought about because of these women's desire for peace.
And then ultimately, I know in a number of places around the world that the drive for democracy, in particular against authoritarian regimes, driven by women raising this issue of, you know, is the reason why there's so much violence in society is because we're governed by men, particularly in military regimes. What comes to mind to me are, you know, examples in the southern cone of South America, where, you know, Brazilians began organizing not just on redemocratization, but demanding greater women's rights based on those same principles, and the rise of people like Michelle Bachelet in Chile and Cristina Kirchner in Argentina, kind of leading to that. So I guess the question then, Robert, I'll ask you then, is the linkages between women's empowerment, the expansion of the suffragist movement, and just new conceptions of what democracy means, how much that demonstrates the suffragist movement, women participating in the democracy, and just in general raising issues about peace and war.
Yeah, so I think that that is one of the striking things when we're working on this book and we're seeing these effects of democracy, and we're realizing that support for democracy within many democratic countries is declining, particularly among younger people. The younger you are, the less you support democracy today. And I think Jocelyn and I have both had the experience of saying to our students, you know, what's going on with you guys? What rights do you want to give up? So we have, on the one hand, these benefits that are being highlighted of democratic institutions when they're real democratic institutions that include the entirety of adult populations. And on the other hand, we're seeing the sacrifices that people are making for democracy around the world that you're pointing out, because you know, even though we think of today women's suffrage as sort of a settled issue, and I think it was with Saudi Arabia back in 2015 when they extended in municipal elections, extended the vote to women, that was sort of the last country to have elections that would that didn't include women. So now everybody does, but the real degree, the real influence, the protections of women to actually make their voices heard are still completely different around the country. In many places, there are great dangers in Afghanistan and Iraq, and lots of places, there are great dangers to women who do express their voices. So, you know, we have certain formal forms of democracy in some places, but not what we think of as, you know, full protections to actually express voices. And yes, we are pointing to the vote as a critical factor, but it's the vote interacted with social movements that seem to be really important. And women need to be a part also of those social movements.
When we return, we're going to discuss not just women as voters and women as influencers, but women as leaders, and raise that question we always seem to raise in classrooms: what if women ruled the world? Would the world be more peaceful? What does the historical record suggest? And what ultimately does the data on women as voters suggest about women as leaders as well?
When we come back, what is the relationship between women voting, electing women leaders, and women-led groups in civil society on war and peace? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Does the expansion of the vote to women lead to the election of women as leaders? And are these leaders more committed to peace than their male counterparts? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we are examining the relationship between women's political empowerment, notably the suffragist movement and the expansion of the vote to women, and the way in which women have framed issues of war and peace, the politics of war and peace. We're discussing a new book entitled The Suffragist Peace, How Women Shape the Politics of War. And our guests are the authors of the book, Robert Traeger, who's an associate professor, full professor in the political science department in the University of California, Los Angeles, and Jocelyn Barnhart, who's associate assistant professor at the Department of Political Science at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and also a senior research scientist at DeepMind in London. So when we left off, we were, you know, talking about issues of women, you know, as leaders and that impact. But Jocelyn, I'll ask you, the book makes numerous references to the fact that historically women as leaders aren't necessarily all that, you know, all that more peaceful. We were discussing, I was discussing the book with my producers. One of the first things that came to mind is the number of references you make to Catherine the Great. And ultimately, when thinking of, you know, women who are just as ruthless as men, Catherine the Great sort of at the top of the list. So I guess the first question is, historically, has there been any difference between women and men when they were, you know, in positions, decision-making positions, and had the ability to wage war?
The first thing to note is that we just have very little data to go on here because the number of women leaders in the historical record is very slim. So it is really difficult to say with strong confidence what the answer is to that question. We certainly have numerous historical figures. Boadicea, it has a variety of pronunciations, but the historical figure here in the UK, who drove the Romans out with her incredibly brutal tactics, I think is at one end of the spectrum. And I think, we have a number of other women rulers who, as you say, Catherine the Great, Maria Theresa, we think of Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady. We think of a number of other, contemporary female leaders who have also deemed themselves Iron Ladies of one thing, one country or another, right? So we have a historical record that strongly suggests that, that does not point in the direction of pacifism, that's for sure. It's hard to say statistically, as I mentioned, but certainly it's easy kind of to think about a model in which women leaders have to play against type, right? That in order to get into those positions of power, in order to appeal to and to an electorate, that it makes sense to embody the narratives that have been used in the past, to embody images of strength and leadership that often have these, you know, these tones of being ready for conflict and not, you know, backing down in the face of a threat, and all of these things that we think about more masculine forms of leadership. So I think we mentioned a number of cases in the book where, you know, in fact, Margaret Thatcher took voice lessons so her voice could be lowered so that she would come across as more masculine. So I think we have lots of evidence that women leaders have to think about these things, right? The conceptions of leadership are still very, very much rooted in and centered around masculine traits. I think that we don't know. But we also mentioned in the book that, you know, I think that changing those conceptions of what leadership that looks like is therefore a really important part of this, if in fact women are to have their full impact on the balance of war and peace.
Although, Robert, even in sort of going to later 20th century, but what we might call kind of these women in this traditionalist masculinist model, there are still some interesting developments that highlight the feminine nature. I think of Golda Meir, for example, in Israel, who was both known as being very, very tough and willing to retaliate against, you know, for instance, the Munich Olympics attacks and the so-called sort of, you know, Gideon case, but also the grandmother of the nation. And the idea that there's kind of a protection nurturing element with the way that, you know, with the way that she approaches that. So is that a simple, I know the role of women in Israel within the IDF, the role of women, you know, within politics is pretty unique, or at least, you know, Israel has some real unique areas, but are there lessons that we can draw from that you could be both very feminine, but also very much driven to, you know, willingness to wage war, to protect the family, to protect the community?
Yeah, I think that it's fair to say that many, many, all women leaders confront this. Many women leaders have leaned into, if they've leaned into them, to a perception of themselves as a mother, it's often a fierce mother, right? It's sort of a mama bear mother. And many women have described themselves in leadership positions, have described themselves actually in masculine terms. So for instance, Golda Meir, you mentioned, liked to tell the story of another prime minister supposedly saying of her when she was in the cabinet that she was the only man in the cabinet. And Indira Gandhi liked to say that she was a biform human being. That was her self-description, neither man nor woman, even though she conformed very much to traditional gender roles in her personal life. But there's a public persona which is different. So I think every woman is confronting this. These are extraordinarily difficult waters to navigate. And you know, as Jocelyn said, we don't know if women leaders in the past have been more warlike. But if you are guessing, the evidence is on that side, right? Especially in the era of kings and queens, it's harder to say today because, as Jocelyn said, there are so few women leaders. I think when we wrote the book, there were 22 out of several hundred women leaders in the world. And, you know, people don't realize just how few there are, but actually, you know, if the current trends continue, I think it's a couple hundred years before we would see gender parity at the executive level. So yes, we don't have much data, but the data that we do have suggests that if you were betting, you would bet that women leaders of the past had been more aggressive. And the question of why that's the case is a fascinating one.
Jocelyn, both you and Robert have raised this issue because there is a lack of data on this question. From a methodological perspective, there is such a tendency then to rely on anecdote with it. So I guess I'll ask the methodological question. What role does anecdote play in all of this? And possibly, you know, stating, but maybe overstating, you know, a handful of cases. and especially in the political discourse broadly about, I mean, if women ruled the world, would it be, you know, more peaceful or less peaceful? And ultimately, the question usually comes, well, I mean, Margaret Thatcher waged war against Argentina.
Absolutely. I mean, anecdote is limited as a source for judgment, right? I mean, I think we have intuitions about things, and those intuitions can be based on, you know, our broad perceptions of patterns in the world. But of course, you know, as we say, these are average tendencies. These are not categorical. This is nothing, you know, of course we would expect to see, you know, women leaders who were warlike and male leaders who were, you know, very much pacifists. And so I don't think that that's really evidence on either side. But I do think, you know, I think if we look at the importance of social movements in some of these countries, like in Israel, they had the vote, right? But the vote itself in 1999, 2000, when this group, the Four Mothers, was actually trying to get their sons back from Lebanon, right? The vote was not sufficient in that case. They actually needed social movements to put their issues onto the political sphere, right? And to essentially normalize these ideas in the political dialogue, right? And I think that that's indicative of something broader, which is that you need narratives, political narratives, actually, that incorporate women's preferences, right? If the existing political dialogue only occurs at one end of the spectrum, which it is, you know, if we are threatened, we must respond, and those who back down are weak, et cetera, well, then that suggests that we're not even able to vote on, you know, the full range that would represent women's preferences. So hopefully, you know, it's clear how that extends to women leaders, which is to say, if they only can get elected by saying things that are you know, essentially not representative or at the more violent end of the extreme, then we haven't gotten a good read yet on what women leaders would do if, in fact, political discussions, political narratives and dialogues included more women, you know, more pacifist preferences, if that makes sense.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing a new book, The Suffragist Peace, How Women Shape the Politics of War, with its authors, Robert Traeger of the University of California, Los Angeles, and Jocelyn Barnhart of the University of California, Santa Barbara, and also of DeepMind in London. So we've explored the big sort of broad question about women as voters and kind of broadly the impact they have on discourse. And we've focused on leaders, but Jocelyn raises a really important question I'd like to focus this last part on. And that's the role of women-led and women-inspired social movements, of civil society, the role that activists have played. And so, Robert, is this question about women having the right to vote and the ability to vote and actually turning out to vote, is that the most effective way that women have had this impact on framing the politics of peace and war? Or has it been the role that activists have played that have helped to frame this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So before women had the vote, there were activists, there were peace movements, there were women's movements for peace. Of course, there were men's movements for peace, but these women's movements for peace, they weren't so effective. They could pretty easily be ignored. There's something about the vote which really gives power. I mean, that is the extraordinary thing about democracy, isn't it? That it gives power. You can go into a voting booth, and when you're in the voting booth, there's nobody watching you. It's not like you're a leader and you have to present a certain image to be elected or to convince people to make you a leader. You're by yourself in the voting booth and you get to say what you think. And so, you know, I think people in democracies take that extraordinary power for granted, but people who have not had that, they do not take it for granted, and they come to understand just how powerful it is. And so I think the combination of the social movement and the vote is so powerful, because you convince people to do that thing when they're by themselves in the voting booth. You can't really just have one without the other. But if you don't have the vote, then the sort of backstop, the power backstop, doesn't exist, and you don't seem to see the same effects.
Jocelyn, the suffragist movement had this impact on the peace movement at the end of the First World War. The one organization that I was pretty familiar with, because a colleague of mine has written about the Women's International League of Peace and Freedom, that's always well known. And that would, of course, support Robert's argument that this group has even more power because they have the right to vote. But that, as a factor here, that it's more than just the right to vote, but organizing around that right to vote to have that impact. So I guess first, how much did the suffragists, you know, have an impact on the peace movements between the wars? And then maybe what kind of lessons we may have for today's politics?
Yeah, I think if we think about, you know, the group you mentioned, I mean, so they, you know, a group of women came together at The Hague in 1915. They had this, you know, meeting that was intended to try and hash out, you know, what the grounds for peace in World War I should be. You know, these were women who essentially, some American women who traveled across the seas during wartime and gathered at this place. It was, you know, I can't remember, but let's say, you know, 100 miles from the front or whatever it may be. And from this, they kind of took the lessons, I guess, the major, you know, path to peace that they saw, and they took a tour of world leaders, and they went to talk to, you know, the leaders of the warring parties, the warring countries, including Wilson and many others, and they made their pitch for peace, and they were dismissed, right? I mean, I think it was just so easy to say, isn't that very sweet, right? Like, how idealistic. But speaking to Robert's point, it's, you know, the fact that once they got the vote, then, you know, they could, you know, I think that, you know, we have that it's much harder to ignore, I should say. But if we're talking about kind of the intersection of these two movements, you know, I think that during World War I, there was a big divide amongst the suffragists about what they should prioritize. And so you did see the split of these suffragist camps, in which, you know, those who had once been in the same boat on, like, well, how do we get to peace? We get there through the vote. Well, suddenly, you know, in a time of world war, it became treasonous to argue that, in fact, you should not be fighting for your country. And so instead of isolating or alienating others to their cause, in essence, they took a step back from peace, right? And actually just focused on getting women the vote. Others decided to go the other direction and to say, no, if our outcome is peace, we need the vote. So I think that, you know, it was a difficult decision, I think at the time, to know how to prioritize and to not essentially alienate potential supporters by seeming treasonous and unpatriotic. Yeah, so I don't know, what are the lessons for the current day from this? I mean, I do think that it's oftentimes, you know, often that you need social movements, as we keep saying, to essentially raise the profile of agendas and to open the political narrative, open the rhetorical space to include a broader range of acceptable issues. And I think that's what social movements can do. I think that we see efforts like obviously, Russia is not, you know, not going to rank highly on the democracy scale at this point. But right, you have women's groups that are trying to make it acceptable to come out and say things in against the war, right? And that happens within democracies too, that you need to channel different views of the world and create common knowledge that those views are acceptable. So I do see those things as very much complementing each other. Yeah.
Robert, sort of on that same trend, this week that we're recording, we are also remembering it was 20 years ago that the U.S. invaded Iraq. And of course, in the midst of all this is Russia's invasion of Ukraine. How much have women, you know, had an impact on those questions? I was also reminded, was it 25 years ago, 24 years ago, was the bombing of Kosovo in Yugoslavia. So, I mean, certainly there's still quite a bit of military action to say that there's this peace movement that's dominated global politics is, you know, too broad of a statement. But there's also a gender gap in voting. Is it fair to say that we're moving in a trend towards a more peaceful world? Or in these moments of crisis, these moments of decision about going to war, there really hasn't been anywhere near as much of an impact. Women calling potentially for more peace hasn't had anywhere near as much of an impact as maybe we would have suggested.
Well, they can't do everything. They're you know, there are other factors that are determining whether or not we go to war for sure. Yeah, they can't do everything. It's hard to know where the world is going. You know, there are just all these cross-cutting things. We mentioned the lack of support for democracy. That's fascinating to see where that's going to go, where technologies are taking us. There has been a trend over time of broader women's inclusion. So if that does continue, I think there's some reason to think that the world can become more peaceful. So I think, you know, another lesson though is that we simply need, if we're going to have greater inclusion of women, that might also mean more women leaders. And as we said before, you know, I think we need a different understanding of what leadership is a little bit, one that maybe makes more room for leadership that looks a little bit different and expresses preferences in maybe a different way. And I think it'd be very interesting to see what changes that brings about. You know, we don't know for sure, but I think many of us are very interested to see what that could mean. So I think, you know, you asked about sort of policy implications. I think that's one. We can change what we mean by a leader a little bit, or have a broader understanding and maybe less gendered or gendered in a different way. That would be very interesting. And then also, I think the broader civil rights for women, that so that they can engage in the democratic process. You know, you mentioned Iraq. You know, that was a fascinating case. That and in other similar cases where there has been an attempt to set up a democracy after conflict, there are these questions about gender rights versus other things. And in many cases, there's a kind of trade that's been made. You know, we don't want to push too hard on gender rights because that would be too controversial. We want to get some democratic institutions. But I think it's important to realize that when you give up on gender rights, you're giving up on some of the benefits that we associate with democracy.
Yeah. And with that, I would, you know, add the case of Afghanistan with the U.S. withdrawal and, you know, any potential vestiges of democracy being tossed aside, and that paralleling a total backsliding on women's rights there as well. So ultimately, Jocelyn, the book addresses a lot of different issues, the role that women play within, you know, peace and conflict discourses, the history of women. But I think as we started this conversation, I think what you ultimately were trying to accomplish with the book is to show that the democratic piece is a lot more complex, and that the book wants to contribute to understanding the complexity, that it's not just democracy, but processes within democracy. So, I mean, ultimately, where should the research agenda go in addressing that question?
That is a great question. I mean, I've started to see much more investigation of kind of what the basis of the gender gap is. I do think we have intriguing aberrations within some of that, like some of the research that suggests, you know, if you ask people about going to war for humanitarian purposes, for going to save human lives in war-torn places, actually, in some cases, women can be more supportive of the use of force than men. So I don't think, we certainly don't know the whole story about how kind of preferences are distributed and what prompts women to, you know, support conflict at equal rates of men. So I certainly think there's a lot to do on that front.
And so with that, I think ultimately what we draw from all of this is the importance of research on the role of gender, the who's voting, how often they're voting, how that's had an impact on discourses on peace and conflict, you know, sorts of issues, and opening the door to where if we say perhaps there's a law that democracies don't go to war with one another, that begins a conversation and begins a research agenda that really calls for much more depth into trying to understand if that's true, why it's true. And what's wonderful about that is we have this new book that hopefully we'll all get a chance to read, and it contributing to the discourses about democracy, about gendered international relations, peace and conflict issues. The title of the book is The Suffragist Peace: How Women Shape the Politics of War. It's been the topic of our conversation today. The authors of that book and our guest today have been Robert Traeger. He's a full professor in the political science department at the University of California, Los Angeles. And he's also the author of a forthcoming book, Diplomacy, Communication and the Origins of International Order. And Jocelyn Barnhart, who is assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of California at Santa Barbara. She is also a senior research scientist at DeepMind in London and the author of The Consequences of Humiliation, Anger and Status Threat in International Politics. Thank you both very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.
Many people wonder where my secret lies. I'm not cute or built to suit a fashion model size. When I start to tell them, they think I'm telling lies. I say, it's in the reach of my arms, the span of my hips, the stride of my step, the curl of my lips. I'm a woman, phenomenally. I walk into a room just as cool as you please, and to a man the fellows stand or fall down on their knees. Then they swarm around me, a hive of honeybees. I say, it's the fire in my eyes, the flash of my teeth, the swing in my waist, the joy in my feet. I'm a woman, phenomenally. Men themselves have wondered what they see in me. They try so much, but they can't touch my inner mystery. When I try to show them, they say they still can't see. I say, it's in the arch of my back, the sun of my smile, the ride of my breasts, the grace of my style. I'm a woman, phenomenally. Now you understand just why my head's not bowed. I don't shout or jump about or have to talk real loud. When you see me passing, it ought to make you proud. I say, it's in the click of my heels, the bend of my hair, the palms of my hands, the need for my care. Because I'm a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman, all you women and me.